Greetings and salutations, everyone. This, once again, is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net is here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. I began 40-plus years ago under the direction of Dick K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key 2 years ago. We miss him, but we continue in his memory and hopefully learn new things and teach other people new things. And it's all part of the process. If you don't learn something new each day, you've kind of failed. So with that in mind, let me pause for a second, and I will give you the usual links. Okay, if you need to reach me and you can't reach me here on the net or on the repeater, email is a good place. Things that would be useful for. In the old days, we had these things called mailbag questions. That was from people who, for one reason or another, couldn't attend the technical net. And so they would email different people the questions, and those guys would ask Dick, and Dick would answer it. We get very few of those these days, maybe one every 3 months. But nevertheless, if you have a mailbag question, or if you have a topic of interest, if you would like to do a little presentation on a particular amateur radio topic, or you would like to be part of a conversation about that topic, or you would just like to hear other people have a conversation about that topic, you could suggest it to me through email. Also, we're always looking for puzzles. They're very difficult to find. A lot of people don't realize how difficult it is to find something that can be kind of woven into the fabric of a better understanding of a concept, and that can't be easily Googled and answered that way. But if you have something like that, please share. Or if you would like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a video or a website, space-related or NASA-related, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to contact Paul directly, you can reach him via email at spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have links of all kinds of interesting articles. Please avail yourself of them. Some of them are related to amateur radio, others to just science, interesting YouTubes that I've come across, all kinds of interesting things. And the link is available in perpetuity. So if you don't have time today or tomorrow or the next day, they'll be there next week. So the link page is roy.ac2gs. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's busy as heck. Other times it's as quiet as a mouse. You can get there by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And I have an audio stream. So if you know people who don't have a radio or are too far away and can't use Echolink, if they type into their browser technet.ac2gs.com, that'll bring them an audio stream. It works for 24/7. So it was meant for the TechNet, but I leave it up for the rest of the week. And, of course, remember MikeKC2NJI's AmateurRadio.tv, where he has archives of the technical net going back to September of 2006. Let me drop. Okay. Nothing special tonight planned. We'll take questions, as always. I would prefer if the first few questions are related to amateur radio. Then later on, we'll open it up to any aspects of science, and we even touch on medicine. We do not give diagnosis nor treatment over the radio, but we certainly can discuss any science concept that you wish to bring up. And if I don't know about it, I'm sure someone listening does. So that should take us to about 10:15. Paul will come and give us the SpaceNet report until 11 o'clock, and I'll return and tie a little bow on it. So that's the plan, and hopefully this time, as opposed to the last six attempts, I will have the time and the opportunity to touch upon the concept of radiometers. Some aspects of it are in the news, and an article that Paul's planning to discuss later in the SpaceNet report, so it would go together rather nicely. So with that all in mind, hoping that radios, repeaters, and the world doesn't hiccup, that's my plans for tonight. I'll drop and ask if anyone would like to put their name on the list. Give me your first name and your call sign.
K2TGW, list.
Less recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Pentax Jan, I sent you 10 minutes ago a list of 5 topics for the science section. Actually, it's mostly medical, so you'd be interested in it. Pentax Jan.
Okay, Wes, recognized. I appreciate that you didn't send it during the technical net. Probably would be a little bit easier if it was a little bit earlier than 3 minutes before the technical net. I can only read so fast, and I didn't really think I had time to pull up the actual individual pages. So I'll take a look at them if and when I have a little bit of free time here. I'm seriously considering the purchase of another head with another brain so I can multitask more effectively for the technical net.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was busy with other things. And then you woke up, oh, it's a tech net. I gotta speed up. Interaction.
Okay, it's all right, Wesley. We'll figure it out somehow. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, AC2GS. Name's Roy. If you are interested in bringing up a topic or asking a question, please hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
This is JD2IMU. Name is Gary. I am just listening for an interesting topic.
Okay, and I hope we deliver them to you. Okay, I before we begin the first part of the usual technical net, just want to remind people, we discussed Jeff, who is on Echolink, who is the net control operator for the PAPA antenna technical net every Friday night, 10 o'clock our time. Check it out. You can reach it through different places. Just kind of Google PAPA net. He mentioned that the Easy NEC antenna simulation software was going to become free. The story was that Roy Llewellyn, who was the software writer for it and maintained it and charged a reasonable fee, was going to retire. So he put in a extra bit of effort and came out with version 7.0, which he graciously made available for free. So it's just a Google away. Go to the website, download it, and play with it. It's a lot of fun. If you're interested in antennas and antenna theory, it lets you do all kinds of fun things. And, you know, we might go into it further, as the weeks and months go on and I plumb the depths of it. But it's a very interesting piece of software, and there are ways of getting it terribly wrong, but there are ways of getting very good results. So take a look at it, Easy NEC. Just hit the Google away. Let me drop for a second and ask if there's anyone else out there who has any questions or comments tonight and would like to be put on the list. Okay, another quiet beginning. Les, K2TGW, how are you, and what do you got to say?
Good evening, sport fans. I had an interesting transaction in Alabama, Georgia, signs from Texas. Advertising some radios that you're selling for an ad. In fact, put a low offer on Kenwood TM521A, 1980s, 1.2 gig FM transceiver. Interesting enough, 20 years ago, I sold this same amp, a similar rig, I think I sold it a gig rig, and a 1.2 antenna. And he didn't want to sell it for so cheap, but he said he's going to get even and send me a refurbished TM521A. Now I have no longer have any antennas from that time. They were pretty heavy with a number of others. They were like 10 Limark members who are into 1.2 gig. Now if I think it's 6 or 7, it'll be a lot. But could not afford not to buy it. Sometimes the better part of me makes me buy things that I really don't need, but I really want. So I had built a number of antennas, a number of mag mounts, and come to, come to. But what is the best size? Quarter, halfway, full wave, 5/8 wave, 7/8 wave, best to build. It's only cutting a one piece of metal and fitting it in a slot, tightening up the Allen screw. That's not the hard part. It's what length. K2TGW with the tech name. Thank you.
Okay, Les, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, there's more ways to skin a cat. Any of those things can be made resident and made operational. It tends to kind of degrade into simplicity and or people who have a particular love for one type of antenna over another. My antenna that I'm getting a lot of stuff out of is a serial 5/8 wave for 10 meters. I find it very effective. I like the takeoff angle. It seems to get out reasonably well. So just for the sake of not being like everyone else in the room, I would probably vote for 5/8. But 1/4, you know, will work certainly with proper radials, or if you're going to put it on a mag mount for a car, you have the metal. I'd be curious, other people out there, anyone out there have any particular opinions about what kind of a 1.2 gigahertz antenna Les should consider for his new radio? Gosh, Les, it's a really tough crowd tonight. Maybe everyone's off on some kind of Memorial Day weekend spree. I don't know what's going on tonight. You must have some kind of favorites. Is there anything you're kind of drawn to? You know, there's a lot of fascinating choices. I mean, yeah, you could go with a half wave. It doesn't need the ground, but then you have to deal with the high impedance. I don't know if it really serves much of a purpose at the length that a 1.2 gigahertz antenna needs to be. It would be an interesting exercise, but I would consider it to be kind of more or less just an exercise. But is there any of these that you particular favor, and why?
I'll be truthful, you know. I know what I'll most likely end up doing is cut one for each quarter wave, half wave, 5/8 wave, 7/8 wave, and see which one works better. Stick it on a pole outside on a mag mount. My trouble is I don't have any more meters for 1.2, like borrow a bird meter. I had a bird meter and I had a slug for it, but I sold all that stuff. Traded. I know the biggest thing is you need height. You want to put it in your basement, I don't care what you do, it's not going to work. Put it up 30 feet, it's going to work almost whichever you use, but some will work better, and I can't crowd for research for which one would be better, quarter, a half, 5/8, 7/8 wave. There's enough metal underneath it that I don't have to worry about the counterpoint problem. The problem is the amount of work to get the most amount out of what I want to do. Back to you, Roy, K2TGW.
Okay, I would love to hear the results of your test. I agree with you. You know, Dick, may rest in peace, had a great line. He said there's three important things about VHF, UHF, microwave, elevation. So, yeah, the higher you can put it, the better you are. And that's why I tend to think, thinking in my head, my own personal easy NEC software running in my head, a quarter wave and a half wave should give you about the same radiation pattern. I think the benefit to a 5/8 is that it cinches up the elevation angle. It has a higher takeoff angle. So, I think that would benefit something like 1.2, you know, to kind of get over any kind of local obstacles. Otherwise, there's really not that much difference. It sort of depends upon how you correct for the high impedance of some of these things and how lossy those transformers are.
I'm not going to have big distance for the coax line out, 10, 12 feet. I'm not afraid of that part. And I know I can get it some other mass that I have, I know it'll be 25, 30 feet up. Yet, one of my thoughts always the capture length of what you're dealing with. If you think with 5/8, 7/8, full wave, you have a bigger capture area. So helps. Compromise for each, benefit for each. Problem is, which is that combination thereof?
Well, yeah, the problem is it gets complicated because it's not only the capture area, but it's the lobes that might fall. Because, you know, you could just have multiple odd harmonics, and it'll resonate, but the lobes will be a mess.
Well, I only have to go to here to Glen Oak, so I'm not worried about that. The chance of anything else is remote. I'm not going to buy a team for it. Am I
going
to talk to them?
Yeah, I understand entirely. And up until recently, I think our club's a 1.2 gigahertz repeater was down. I think Andy mentioned that he had fixed it and put it back in place. So that's a good thing. There was another person who asked a question about it about a year and a half ago to show you how much general interest, unfortunately, 1.2 gigahertz seems to have. As I said before, if you do it right with proper matching components that aren't too lossy, I don't think there's going to be an incredible difference between any of those configurations. And, you know, ordinarily, I think most people would just say slap a quarter wave ground plane and be done with it. But just to be a little bit unusual, I think a 5/8 would be at least certainly it's an interesting experiment. I would love to hear how your results are between the quarter wave and the 5/8.
Well, we'll let you know in a couple of weeks. Maybe my arthritis will allow me to. It wasn't just not terrible problems with it, so limited what I can do. But we'll report back as soon as I get a chance. First, I got to get the rig. Can't mail it until Tuesday. Come from Atlanta, so I can get it Friday or Saturday. I could build something. I know I could build something internally. Put it on the north side of the house, so we'll have it. Maybe next week, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever. As soon as I can, Roy. KW will be clear.
Okay, very good, Les. I wish you good luck, and I'm anticipating some interesting information about 1.2 gigahertz. I must say, I have no experience with 1.2 gigahertz. The highest I go up is 70 centimeters, but I wish you luck, Les, and hopefully we'll chat about this in the weeks to come.
7-3, thank you.
Comment.
Yes, Ed.
K2GJE. I've never used that frequency and probably never will, but TIG welding rod is stiff and cheap, and you can easily cut it in different lengths to experiment. I mean, on 2 meters I'm using right now 5/8 wave, and I have no trouble hearing more than I can even reach over.
Okay, that's an interesting choice, but you can probably get aluminum rods at the Home Depot and such.
TIG welding rod, I think, is 100 thousandths of 0.1 inches, and it fits very nicely into mag mounts, over.
Okay, that's something for Les to think about. Thank you very much, Ed.
I have another idea. How about a vertical dipole?
Yeah, it certainly is a choice. I mean, it sort of depends. If you're doing it for repeater work, repeater antennas tend to be horizontally polarized. But if you're doing it for, you know, the heck of it, where it's indeterminate what the other station's polarization angle is going to be, that's a possibility.
So I said a vertical dipole, two quarter lengths that's separated by something that inside of the dipole, each end on something and keep it that way. That could be done, right? I know I've had plenty of 2 meter vertical dipoles.
Comment.
Yeah, one second, Ed. Yeah, you can do that. There's nothing that says you can't rotate a dipole into the vertical position. It solves some problems for lower frequency dipoles that you don't have to worry about the getting it too close to ground to get a very distorted radiation pattern. But yeah, you could flip it and wouldn't take up that much space. That's another option for Les to consider. Ed, you wanted to say something.
How about a Yagi with one reflector and a couple of directors? You'll probably knock the hell out of the repeater over.
Well, Les made a comment that he's not really interested in a beam antenna. He doesn't really think he needs that kind of gain.
They're so small and so easy to build over.
Okay, yeah, I agree with you, but, you know, if sometimes people don't want to deal with either they don't want it pointed in one particular place and or they don't want to start setting up rotators and such, so a nice omnidirectional antenna sometimes is more suitable. Anyway, any more comments on this subject before we move on? Okay. Wes's question sounds like it's going to be more science than amateur radio, so for the sake of people who really prefer discussions about amateur radio at the top of the technical net, if someone out there has a question about amateur radio and would like to offer it up to the technical net, please hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, no takers out there. I'm hoping that some people will come late to the show and inject a little bit more participation and questions and such. We shall see. So, Wesley, you have a set of five topics you would like to discuss, apparently.
Yes, I do. Actually, it's more than that, but I didn't have the time to prepare all of it and send it. But yes, there are five of them that are listed in the email. The first one was tattoo-like sensors that reveal blood oxygen levels. And the interesting thing is that it's a silk-based material. So it's a material that is used for the clothing, and it's under the skin. It changes the color in response to the oxygen, and in the future might be adapted to track glucose and other blood components. And it's based on the sensor, let me jump, which is limited to reading oxygen levels and is made out of gel formed by protein components of silk and is being called fabrain. I wonder if that is a subject that's the first link when you click on it is somehow familiar to you. It was actually developed by United States Department of World Technology. So it's okay, so Department of Defense. So there was a program of Department of Defense, and let's make this kind of revelation. Dr. Roy.
Okay, I mean, I don't know a great deal about it. It's interesting. I don't know if it's practically incredibly revolutionary. Most people have heard in the last 2 years of the coronavirus about these little fingertip oximeters. What they do is they shine light on your fingernail, and by analyzing the wavelength of light reflected back, it can approximate the oxygen saturation of the capillaries in your underneath your nail bed. So there are other ways of having the oxygen content read in a non-invasive way, But, you know, it's an interesting research project. I don't know exactly if it has a lot of practical value in its present form, but, you know, research very often leads to breakthroughs and things that you can't possibly imagine at the beginning of the journey.
What actually caught my attention is that I thought that the detector, which is made out of shield, has to be surgically placed underneath of the skin. And I only that by the syringe. So it's such a small one. And in some forms it looks like a tattoo and can be functional, telling how much of oxygen you're using when exercising, measuring blood glucose level at any time of the day, or monitoring number of different blood components, or exposure to environmental toxins. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be talking about toxins later on, because subject is mostly related to medical field. So the novel sensor I'm reading right now is currently limited to reading oxygen level, and is made up from gel form from protein components of silk called fibrin. The silk fibrin proteins have unique properties that make them especially compatible and implantable material. And they are reassembled into the gel or film. They can be adjusted to create a structure that lasts on the skin from weeks to over a 1 year. When the silk does break down, it is compatible with the body and unlikely to invoke immune response. So that's about that.
Relay this question.
Ed, you wanted to say something?
Yes, a related question. When you go now to your primary care physician, they have equipment to measure your oxygen level. Why are they doing that now? They never did that years ago, over.
Well, I mean, that was one of the things that I heard a lot on regular radio and TV shows. The hypoxia from cases of coronavirus. A lot of times what was happening is people first started off with those vague flu-like symptoms and then progressed to shortness of breath. And there was a lot of recommendations that people buy these relatively inexpensive. Nowadays you can get a good quality pulse oximeter for about $50. And if you notice that your oxygen saturations are dipping below your normal level, It's a danger sign that you're starting to decompensate. So it was a big thing at the very beginning of the coronavirus scare to just kind of give people an objective reference point. You know, some people are deniers, so, you know, they might say that their shortness of breath isn't really serious, but, you know, if you could measure it and find out that your oxygen saturation, you know, is below 90%, there's something going on. They might be expanding it in general use for people with any kind of respiratory problems, a history of congestive heart failure and a bunch of other things that could undermine your oxygen saturation level. Pulse oximeters were a thing that you only saw in ICUs way back when they were first invented, because they were rather expensive. Again, now you could go to Amazon and pick up a couple for $100.
No. It is a small disc made out of silk, or could be made out of gel and injected under the skin. Oxygen sensor and glows purple when exposed to ultraviolet light and oxygen. And detector can determine the level of oxygen by the brightness and the duration of the purple glow. So, in comparison, people are often being able continuously monitor their level of oxygen by very much bulky devices, and it's very much uncomfortable to them and to the healthcare facilities to have those bulky machines connected to the patients. And the idea by Department of Defense was granted because pilots, when they go to very high altitude, they have a problem of oxygen. So they need to know if they have any kind of problems with attention or health, and that was why a plenty of money was put into it, and actually technology landed in the civil world. And to XG and Dr. Roy.
Okay, I just a couple of things. Wesley, I think you have a faulty microphone connector, because every so often it'll drop down by a lot of decibels and cut out. So I think there's a contact that if you move the cord a certain way, it does it. I'm just guesstimating here. But I just wanted to touch base with Ed if I answered the question sufficient, because he did break in with a side question related to some of this.
Yes, thank you so much. It's good to have a doctor in the house. One of my relatives got a degree in electrical engineering, and he was working on a lot of these new items which now doctors have other than in the OR. He decided through all the things that he was working on to get into the medical field. Just a comment, over.
Ah, good for him. That's great. Let me drop and make sure I got it. Okay. Yeah, there's all kinds of interesting people kind of pick up medicine as a second profession. The first microcomputer, the Altair 8800, was developed by an engineer, and he started his own company, and things didn't quite go well, and he folded the company and went to medical school and became a doctor. So good for them. Just getting back to the pulse oximeters, I mean, they're not incredibly accurate, but they're relatively inexpensive and light. You could probably build one into a pilot's glove. Sometimes these research projects have an obvious problem to be solved, and other times it's a little bit more nebulous. I mean, it probably would be much more useful if they could design a tattoo that was able to report blood sugar, because there's so many diabetics, and one of the obvious keys to less complications in long-term diabetics is good control of their blood sugar. So this might be a prelude to something more important and better. But yeah, fibroin, it's a protein. I guess theoretically you could become allergic to it under some circumstances, but it's not a particularly allergen, and so it's a silk protein, and I look forward to future evaluation and development.
Okay, I hope now it's going to be better. I've raised the power from 4 watts to 8 watts right now, and directed antenna to the repeater.
Okay, I don't really think that's the problem. It sort of sounds like just the electronics of your microphone are kind of experiencing increased resistance.
Do you see the problem right now?
No, I don't. But it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen often. You know, in say 20 minutes of a general conversation, I'll sometimes hear it at most twice for about 5 to 10 seconds.
Okay. Okay, the next subject, ocean acidification. So I was under the impression that oceans and large water reservoirs are immune to the acids created by CO2. And I was wrong. So the next link that you have in your email talks about carbon dioxide that is absorbed into ocean and interacts with more water molecules, H2O, and forms a weak acid. And this acid is called carbonic acid H2CO3. So when acids dissolve in the water, they break apart. In case of carbonic acid, it breaks into hydrogen ions, so that would be H plus, and bicarbonate ions HCO3 minus. And some of the ions remind us the hydrogen ions, which lowers the pH and makes the water more acidic. So, scientists from the University of Alaska found the method. Actually, they built the robot with German scientists that is able to see the level of acid and measure the CO2 as well as measure methane and leaks in underwater gas pipes. With some articles that I was able to read, I didn't put all of those links there, it is alarming. So not only alarming is that we have a climate change and we're losing ice on how to say it properly, the deposits of ice, the temperature is getting much higher right now. But we also actually create the acids in the water that affects bio life inside of it. Maybe you can say a few words about it. And to
well, that, by the way, AC2GS, acidification has been going on in different ways for many years. We had problems with car exhausts and such producing acid rain that was more corrosive than the usual type of rain. A carbonic acid solution can be problematic, but I'm sure almost everyone out there has had a glass of the stuff, except that we call it seltzer. So carbon dioxide is easily absorbed into water, and it's carbonated beverages are basically all carbonic acid solutions. To a certain extent, I would assume that complicated ecosystems like oceans have all kinds of interesting mineral deposits that can kind of shove the equilibrium back where it belongs to a degree. But like all things, these equalization points are not written in stone. Eventually, if you keep acidifying stuff, it'll have a negative effect, and the pH will rise, and organic systems will thrive less. And if they're given long enough of a chance, they'll evolve to tolerate the increased acidity, or otherwise they'll just die out. So, yeah, I mean, this was kind of coming, but I don't think even now people know the extent, because again, there is a self-correction mechanism in nature for many things, and it's very complicated and very difficult to model. And so time will give us a better idea of how much we're ruining this this world of ours.
Okay. The current research has focused on the biological effects that would be carbonate ions on organisms for calcium carbonate shells, the skeletons that would be plankton, crabs, clams, oysters, corals. I know that there are colonies of corals in very big danger right now, and scientists are trying to make all of the effort to make them alive. In more acidic water, calcifying organisms exert more energy from the shells and skeletons, which can result in slower growth and thinner abnormal shells. I understand it is like if you have less energy or leave the less energy to find food and reproduce, you're actually losing them. So reduction in pH makes harder for organisms to build and maintain their shells. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong, but the same can be said about too basic a environment. Life evolves to be optimized for an equilibrium condition, and there is a lot of all kinds of interesting buffer minerals in the seas that tend to correct for not terribly abysmal shifts, and evolution tends to optimize creatures for that pH. If you ever kept tropical fish, they don't like it too acidic, but they don't like it too basic either. So you could err on the other side just as easily. So again, it really, the most important thing is to figure out for sure how much you can push the carbon dioxide dissolved in sea without wreaking incredible havoc. And like all things, the coral is a complicated problem. It's not all due to one thing. It's due to a number of things, and it's very difficult to separate them out. So in principle, I agree with you. And in generality, I think we should kind of start to reverse the trend of pouring as much carbon dioxide as we have over the last 100 years. But that's going to impact on a lot of people's wealth and prosperity and jobs. And so, you know, we're going to have to find some way of fixing the problem without making people so unhappy that they decide to go into denial and just say the hell with it. We'll deal with it when the ocean is boiling.
Okay. So now I have a short quote. Scientists, the Alaska Fairbanks Ocean Acidification Research Center, that is in the state of Alaska, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's a government program. They built a robot which is not able to use GPS, but it's able to be programmed, and like a submarine goes to about 1.5, that would be 2 kilometers down, to see what's going on there. And yes, they found the acidification of corals, and they found that it likely depend on the species and their geographical location. So some corals use biocarbonate instead of carbonite to build their skeletons. Others can handle wide range of pH values, and I have a pH meter actually in my lab, but I barely use it. I'm not so good in chemistry, but I have a guy who is. So pH 7.8, that is a kind of dangerous for waters. So we're trying to be at 7.5. Into Aegean. Okay, so this in even more in even more acidic conditions with pH as low as 7.5, the crabs, the red crabs, cannot survive. So That's actually what is happening. Alaska is definitely losing on food delivery. I wonder how many guys they're listening to us like scraps. Back to you.
Well, you realize that a pH, a neutral pH is 7. So actually, a pH of 7.5 is slightly basic in chemistry talk.
Yeah, so what they say is 7.5. In even more acidic conditions with pH as low as 7.5, red king crabs could not survive. So, that's the quote. And to exit.
Okay, but it's just I'm trying to make sure that people kind of understand that acidic is a direction and basic is another direction. Neutral, where there's no hydronium ions, no hydrogen ions, is 7.0. That's what neutral pH is. Sodium bicarbonate. If you take some distilled water and you put a teaspoon or two of sodium bicarb, it gives you a pH of about 8.7 or so. Things like hydrochloric acid and nitric acid have pHs of 1 and 2. So the problem is that ocean life is used to a slightly alkaline environment, and the dissolved carbon dioxide is decreasing its pH from its optimum to a slightly more acidic direction. But the ocean isn't acidic per se. It's just less alkaline. It's more of a way of talking about these things than anything. But that's what chemists kind of think in terms of. There's alkaline solutions, there's acidic solutions. If it has a pH of higher than 7, it's an alkaline solution. It may be a very weak alkaline solution, but it is an alkaline solution, not acidic.
Thank you for the explanation. Quickly, what can we do about ocean acidification? That's a quote. Changes to energy standards promoting sustainable energy initiatives, promoting carbon taxes to polluters, reduce carbon footprint, so that would be reduce your energy use and waste of energy and hot water. I like hot water.
Easy to be on.
Go ahead.
Yes.
How you doing, Roy? I think we're both in complete accord here. That just about everything Wes is talking about now is a talking point. It's not actual chemistry. There's so much buffering capacity in the ocean that it's a bit silly to even talk this way. And on top of that, we have so much solid carbonate lying in the sand and in the bottom of the ocean that, or in the mid depths, or really anywhere, that just by a sheer mass action, there's really no way that's ever going to happen. What he's talking about.
Well, yeah, I would tend to agree with you. The ocean has great buffering capability. I mean, there are limitations ultimately. And if we really screw the pooch, we could get to that point eventually. That's why these people probably should spend a great deal more time modeling the complicating buffering situation of the ocean as best they can. In general, I think it's always a good idea to decrease the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's having other effects that are much more important and well-documented. But, you know, guys make studies, they make models, and they find indications, and they kind of run a little bit ahead of themselves. But I think they got to spend a lot more time modeling their environment.
Okay, thank you very much, both of you gentlemen, for correcting my chemistry. I'm not good in it. That was one thing that I couldn't get from my father. He was a teacher of chemistry, too. But anyhow, the next subject is not for me. It's a space report. I'm just pointing it. Boeing Starliner returns to Earth from ISS post conclusion of Orbitech flight test. So that would be space report. It's a competition to Elon Musk, and I wonder who's gonna unless our professional from Space Report is able to comment on it.
What do you want to know, Wes?
Yeah, Boeing spent $600 million, and it was kind of pain for Boeing, which is not big money for them at all. Starliner program. And at the same time, we see ambitious progress of Elon Musk. I wonder how you put those together.
Union versus non-union. You know, most of Boeing stuff and all the contractors they deal with, you're going to have a lot of union contracts. I mean, they're competitive they among each other. But you take a company like SpaceX, I mean, there isn't a union guy in sight. You know, so they're working extremely long hours for, I mean, they're getting good salaries, but, you know, it's a big difference in those environments. So that's what I believe. Anyway, you know, big difference. There's other reasons, but to make a long story short, that's the first one that comes to mind. I guess back to Roy first, right? We're supposed to go back to net control. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. So, Wes, I guess you want to go on to your next one?
Yep. Okay. Australian biotechnology company, Imugene, Imugene, is killing cancer with a virus. The virus is called CF33-HNIS, and it is known as Vaccina. It was developed by Australian biotech company Imugene at the City of Hope Cancer Care Research Center in Los Angeles. The drug is candidate to what is known as oncologic virus, meaning a virus that selectively infects and destroys only cancer cells. So let's ring the bell for you, Dr. Roy.
Well, I've heard of it. It's called Vaccinia, and it's an oncolytic virus, an oncogenic virus you wouldn't want. That would produce malignancy. So this is an oncolytic, which means it kills, it lyses cancer cells. It's part of the broad range of immunological methods that medicine is using to deal with cancer. And, you know, I tend to think that this is probably a very, very valuable road to take. I think ultimately, I've mentioned this before, I might be wrong, they'll be kind of designer of viruses that will be made specifically based upon tissue type of cancers of individual people. The same way that, you know, as soon as they find a new variant on the coronavirus, they can gene type it and develop a RNA, messenger RNA test vaccine. I think that's sort of the future. But, you know, this, again, is very good news. I hope it works out. The big question is, what effect it has on a person, because there are ways of killing cancer that are very effective. If you take a person with cancer and you heat them up to 3,000 degrees, you're not going to get a single cancer cell that survives it. The trouble is you're not going to get a single other cell that survives it. So you have to figure out specificity and risk factors and all kinds of fun stuff. But again, very good. I love success. And you can't pin all your hopes on this particular oncolytic virus, but the principle it will be proven to be sound, hopefully, and more research will give us more ability to deal with cancer.
Okay. The quote that I've seen here is that in clinical trials, it goes well, and the drug is safe for use. More trials involving combination with currently used cancer therapies such as permobirolizumab will be carried out, that's what they say. But the other quote says that it responds to killer cancer as well as stimulates the immune system to be more responsive to other immunology therapies. So it's kind of promising. Dr. Robert, to you.
Okay, I'm trying to get EchoLink back. It dropped out once again, and when the people on EchoLink lose our audio, they talk to each other, and it gets passed to the repeater, and so you end up doubling. So let me just key and unkey a couple of times and see. Ah, I brought it back. Welcome back, people. No, it went away again. Let me see. Let me test. No, I don't know. There's something with EchoLink. It comes in, it goes out. Let me see if it's in again. Testing 1, 2, 3. I think it's back on. So hopefully you guys listening on EchoLink, I'm sorry that the audio fell out. Worst comes to worst, you could try the audio stream at technet.ac2gs.com. That doesn't drop out, but I leave it up to you people. You can be on both at the same time. It shouldn't be a problem. Anyway, Wes, the people on EchoLink, there was about 6 or 7 of them, lost your audio, so you might want to repeat the tail end.
Okay. So, I was reading the quote that there were real treatments taken by, let me go to it, okay, real treatment taken by City of Hope Cancer Center in Los Angeles, and the system respond to kill cancer and to, as well as stimulate the immune system to be more responsive to other immunotherapies, end of quote. So it looks like we're not dealing only with wishes, but we're dealing with real working technology, and that's very much promising to those who might just try it if they have a need for it. I hope that doesn't happen to anybody. The next subject, let me jump. The next subject is actually related to drones. You know that there are some drones created by AGI, and there is a Chinese company that is take most of the drones, and you can buy them in B&H or Adorama for very small money. Of course, there is a need for license. There are drones, I believe under 250 grams, that doesn't need any license whatsoever. But then, so we have a Mavic 2, pretty nice. They can avoid with trees and walls and collisions with themselves. It's a pretty nice company. and pretty much nice product. But what if we have a very strong wind, let's say we have a hurricane,